I want to speak about something which is not a simple case, is one which happens a lot. And the question is like this. Is somebody who is observant, Shomer Shabbat, Shomeret Shabbat, permitted to invite somebody to come for a meal on Shabbat when we know that that person will be breaking Shabbat to get there? So the truth is, in the way I just now formulated it, is I made it more complicated than it needed to be. It could be that you're going to invite them and you don't know what they're going to do. There's a possibility. So I do want to go back there and to admit that. The other thing I want to say by way of introduction is something which either may be completely accurate or may be something completely unfair. And that is, does a posek, somebody who decides halacha, do they operate in a vacuum, or are they going to be impacted by larger situations that are surrounding them? Which means, are other considerations going to come in, which either, by the way, consciously or subconsciously, will then put somebody into a position? I mean, I'll say something in a general level. I gave a talk a couple of years ago on, it was a Friday night, so as far as I know, it was not recorded. But the topic of the talk was the difference between religious Zionism and modern Orthodoxy. So I think there's a lot to talk about in what similar or what may be different. But the first thing that I would identify as a difference will be who are on the two sides of you, which means who are the people that are very important for you to say, I'm not like them. Because the people who are near you, who you need to say, I'm not like them, are then going to be the people who may position you into positions that you subsequently take. Not because you, a priori, believe that this is what I need to do, but rather because you don't want to get confused with that other group, and that's what pushes your way. And I hope you all realize part of the absurdity of this. I mean, if you were to ask, I believe even most Orthodox Jews, the difference on the outside between a Bavur Chassid, a Satmar Chassid, a Gera Chassid, a Vizhnitz Chassid, I think they'll have a very hard time looking at them and saying, well, that's the difference. While if you asked a Vizhnitz Chassid, they say, like, what are you talking about? Don't you see how we're different? Don't you? I mean, it's so obvious what the differences are. So from the outside, they look the same. And it could very well be that from the outside, that you know, for all that today, one of the big fights in America is between modern Orthodoxy, right-wing modern Orthodoxy, open Orthodoxy. But somebody on the outside may look at all of them and say, but you look the same to me. And they'll say, like, what are you talking about? Like, this is like the biggest differences in the world. In Israel, if you'll look at the differences between what we would call the Chardal versus the, I don't know, what's the opposite of Chardal? Of the, and now, by the way, if you'd ask Chardal, they would then say Dati Light, but that's not really fair, because there is something, quote-unquote, Dati Light, and there's something which I would call a non-Chardal, Tzioni Dati, who are just not happen to be Chardal. We say, what is it? Excuse me? It may well be. It may well, no. I wouldn't be so quick on saying that. But I'm going to say it again. Is that like, what are you talking about? Look at the differences between us. But again, somebody looking on the outside may not appreciate them, but I'm going to say it again. How many of the differences between us are caused on a reactive basis as opposed to a proactive basis? How many of the positions of what we really think are important when it comes down to it, I'm sorry for saying this, may really not be important, but are really things that we got pushed into because we don't want to be like somebody else. Was all of that completely unfair, or we accept this as a thought? What? It is. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why I think that modern Orthodoxy and religious Zionism are very different, because the other, who they don't want to be, is a very different other. So once the other is different, then it therefore causes a completely different self-definition. Okay. And I'm sorry I couldn't bring England or South Africa into this, but you're probably better off for it. Let's look at source number one. The big debate was to do source number one first or source number two first. The reason to do source number one first is because it's number one. The other reason is because it's in Igrot Moshe, Arachayim Chelek Aleph Simen Tzadi Chet. The other one is Igrot Moshe, Arachayim Chelek Aleph Simen Tzadi Ted. So which one should come first? Tzadi Chet comes before Tzadi Ted. On the other hand, if you look in the second line of the first source, it says Tammuz Tavshin Tetvav. And the other one, number two, is Mem Laomer Tavshin Yud Gimel. So therefore, what's Tzadi Chet in Rav Moshe Feinstein is from 1956, and the next Tshuva Tzadi Tet is from 1953. So, which one do we do first? We'll do the first one first, because it's number one. And it's Tzadi Chet, even though it was penned later. Balabatim, that's your Bab, Balabatim. So what does Balabatim mean? Balabatim. Sherotzim lasod minyan avur chinuch hayiladim ubarur sheyavo bimishins. That was then later fixed to be bimichuniyot. Bishabbat. Yud gimel tamuz tovshin tedvav ma'alat kvodo yididi harav moreinu v'rabeinu harav Arye Moshe Elio Kaplan Shlita. Now, those of you who don't know who that is somebody who was later on known as Rabbi Arye Kaplan, who wrote some 50 books or so. This, as far as I know, is the only tshuva that Rav Moshe has to Arye Kaplan. It's in 1956, and he was relatively young at this point. He was a teacher in a day school in Louisville, Kentucky, when this tshuva was written. I will admit something that nobody knows, so I don't know if I have to edit this out of the tape, but he has, as I said, over 50 books, and Rabbi Kaplan died relatively young. Those of you who don't know who he is, he was really one of the most impressive authors, translators of Jewish ideas in the 20th century. After he passed away, a number of his books were published. One of them, it was a two-volume set called The Handbook of Jewish Thought. So from what I've been told, it was actually the first book that he worked on. And I won't say who told me. If you want, I'll tell you afterwards. But because he lives in Achlaut. So what I was told was that for many years, nobody could find him. So a little bit of background, and then I have to come back to this. So just a little biography. Rabbi Arye Kaplan was born in New York, in the Bronx, to a non-religious family. And through some serendipity, he ended up meeting a Jewish family who then paid for him to go to yeshiva. But there were no schools for Baal Tshuvas, and he went, or Baalei Tshuva, and he ended up going to Torah Vedat, and went, as a 13-year-old, went to first grade. Very quickly, he went through the grades. By the way, he was a complete genius, and he was supposed to go to the Bronx High School of Science at that point. And he went, and he really, in an amazing way, caught up very quickly in terms of Jewish studies, and then quickly surpassed most people that he knew. And in terms of his secular studies, he was far beyond whatever they were teaching in any yeshiva in Brooklyn at the time. So the person who told me about him once said to me that Arye Kaplan had said when he was young that he wants to get smicha so he'll never have to ask Rav Moshe Feinstein a question. But he said when he was young he was very arrogant, which again it's not nice to say, or very self-confident, whoever you want. He was a genius, and sometimes geniuses are like this. So the first thing he did is he worked on this all of Judaism, which means basically he had in his house like a wall like this with slots. So the first thing he did is he put in each slot each one of the 613 commandments, right, in the order of the commandments. And then every book he would read, he would identify how they fit into one of those categories. And then over the years, he created more and more categories. And then he had essentially index cards, and he wanted to write an encyclopedia of all of Judaism. And that became the Handbook of Jewish Thought. So the first volume, as far as I recall, was still published in his lifetime. The second volume wasn't. So in the second, actually, there's two chapters that were never published, which I have at home, and one of them is on evolution, and I forgot what the other one, it's also something about science and Torah. And I was asked, and by the way, this is no place written any place. I was giving no credit on this, but I was asked to go through the manuscript, and a couple of chapters, I fixed the footnotes. So I can show you, because I just found it recently. For years, I didn't know where this was. I found it recently. So I have his original manuscript, and I have the things I put in. So I will admit that in one place, I added in a tshuva from Rav Moshe as one of his footnotes, just as a tikkun for his neshama, because he said, so I won't have to ask Rav Moshe a question. And then afterwards, I found that he actually did ask Rav Moshe a question. So had I known that, I never would have fixed that footnote in that particular way. So that's the story about the second volume of the Handbook of Jewish Thought. So, in fact, he does ask Rav Moshe. By the way, the other thing is that after this, he later on became a rabbi in conservative shuls, which is why nobody heard of him for a number of years. I have no reason to believe that he himself was anything other than Orthodox, but he did disappear off the map for a number of years, and then he entered back in the Jewish community, and he did writing and translating, but he essentially had all of the footnotes written before he wrote his first book. So he just worked at an incredible pace because he already had all of his footnotes worked out. So here he does turn to Rav Moshe, and let's get back to what is the question that he asks him. He says, the community here knows that there's a lot of kids who are less committed. And I'm going to tell you, and this is Louisville, Kentucky. And they want to know, can we have a minyan on Shabbat for the kids? But the kids are going to they're going to drive them there. Now, what's the question? Is this a question or is this not a question? There's no question or there is a question? So, yes or no? Do you hear a question or no? The question is that we want to do quote unquote kirur. We want to bring these kids closer. We want to be makarev. We want to bring them. And this is how we can do it. What's the other side of the question is that someone's going to break Shabbat in order for this to happen. And is this a fair trade-off? So let's look at what Rav Moshe answers. And I also want to note how he answers. Those are two different things. What he says and how he says it. He named the devar Ratzona Balabatim. Lasot minyan avor yiladim lechancham sheberur sheyavo b'machoniyot. So again, that's why when I pose the question, he goes, for sure they're going to come. V'chalalu haShabbat mitzad rechok hamakom. They're going to get in their cars because they live far away. Pashut uberur sheasur af leknanim she'enu b'nei mitzvah. Even though these kids are under bar mitzvah, it is absolutely forbidden to have such a program and have such a minyan. Dechi chinuch tefillah adif mi chinuch mitzvat Shabbat? Is it better to train these kids in terms of davening as opposed to training them to keep Shabbat? Now, I want to pause right here. Was that really a fair line? But why is it not fair? Right. These are kids who are not keeping Shabbat. So Rav Moshe is saying is, look what you're asking me. You're asking me, well, we want to do chinuch, but again, he's being very myopic, you know, very narrow, and saying, okay, you want to have a minyan Shabbat, but of course it's not just for a minyan, it's not just to teach them how to daven, it's apparently going to be so much more than that. But Rav Moshe says, does that make sense? So by the way, right away, you know which direction he's going, because he says, it's pashut, it's simple, the gam ha, who kimitzuvim ota lavolit palel behaminyan, af baofen shichalu Shabbat, ulachin vade chas v'shalom lehaskim ledavar kaze, shlo lechanech lemitzvot, ela adaraba, lechancham leifuch chas v'shalom. Rav Moshe says, you're not doing anything good by this. You're causing the opposite to happen over here. You're causing these people to break Shabbat. It's not chinuch for a mitzvah, it's a chinuch for an avera. V'ima balabatim lo yishma'u. And if the shul, the board, as it were, are not going to listen, v'it kenua minyan, and they're going to make this minyan anyway, which means you don't have that much of a say in it, shu adura b'kilkul v'havarat aldat. By the way, do you realize where he's going with this? Not only is this is bad, and it's causing people to move away from religion, b'sor shabbat hachamura, causing people to break one of the most important mitzvot, u'kvot teratorah, and so on, ein b'kocho, you don't have the ability, l'hafer etzatam, rak b'mach abidvarim, you don't have the ability of stopping the plan, of only protesting against it, eini ra'ema yechol kvod do la'asot od, I don't know what else you could do other than protest, avu mikol makom tzarech b'kol la'et l'daber b'zeh b'chol me'isur, the whole time, you know, you should speak to them and tell them how serious this is. Ve'im yizdamein eize eitza she'chol lahafer zeh. And if you can to some kind of way of breaking this plan, vada yitchayev lahafer zeh ulevatel et minyan shegorim lechilul Shabbat. You definitely have to break this thing which is causing the breaking of Shabbat. Ubevadai kol zman she'ya minyan yesh lechvado ledaber im kol achad miyeladim biyichud she'yavo beregel. And if you have the ability, you should talk to the kids and tell them to come by foot. Ula yo'il zeh la'achadim mehem. Maybe at least you can save some of them. Kizeo mitzvah tochcha v'limud. Because that is the obligation regarding how we rebuke and how we teach. Yedido Moshe Feinstein. Now, why do you think this tshuv is remarkable? Or did I put words in your mouth? The tshuv is remarkable. He doesn't bring that up at all. Why else is it remarkable? So you're missing the main part, right? Should I help you? He gave no halachic argument. He brought no proof. He brought no sources. There's no discussion here. He didn't say, but it says in the Gemara, and it says in Rashi, or Tosfot look over here, but the Rambam over here, and the Shulchan Aruch had said over here, there are no sources in this tshuva. Because when there are sources, you can argue what the sources mean. So, when there are sources, you can argue how to interpret the sources. When the person doesn't bring any sources, how do you argue? So the question, of course, over here is to what extent is this a question of what I would call public policy, or is this a question in terms of halakha? And again, you can tell me that that's completely unfair for me to make that distinction. How dare I, it's okay, I'll say it for you, how dare I say about Rav Moshe Feinstein that maybe this is just a public policy issue, but it's not a halachic issue. But and I say this, again, really, with all the respect to Rav Moshe, and in case you don't know or don't understand, I absolutely consider Rav Moshe to be the definitive posek of the 20th century, without any hesitation. I say this. And Rav Moshe was a giant, by the way, he was around this tall, but he was a complete giant when it came to halakha and taking responsibility and standing up and stating his opinion and generally writing long, relatively, learned, sourced opinions. So what strikes me about this particular tshuva, and by the way, he published his first volume, which this is in 1959, so we had a backlog of a number of tshuvot, and he publishes these two, one after the other, choosing to put the later one first, which again is interesting. So obviously we have to read the earlier one, which he put in afterwards, and see what he does or what exactly was the question and answer there. But to my mind, again, what's really interesting here, first of all, he's really strong, very strident, very, very, there's no discussion. This is wrong, and any consideration that you have is wrong. You think it's chinuch, it's not chinuch, it's anti-chinuch, it's chinuch for an aveira, it's chinuch for chilul Shabbat, nothing good will come of this. So of course the question then is, what's his source? Why is he so strong? And what's going on? And I hate to say it, but I can't debate it, because there's no sources, is he right? Or is there room to argue? So let me now continue. Source number two. Biur iser sheyesh b'hazbanat anashim, explaining the prohibition of inviting people, sheyavo l'tpalel b'beit ha'knesset b'shabbat, kishyodim sheyavo b'mishins, mem la'omer tov shin yud gimel. And you now all know what mishins means by Rav Moshe. I guess, it's a Yiddishism. So, again, part of the problem with both of these tshuvot is Rav Moshe doesn't quote, and by the way, he doesn't quote the question. We don't know what they asked. We don't know how they explained the situation. We know how he processed the question, and what is the question? Can people drive to shul on Shabbat? Or even better, why is this not allowed? So let's continue. Nishalta me Rav Rav Naftali Kalibach, me Detroit, by the way, what just now changed between the first one and the second one? By the way, and you notice the title of today's class is Lifnei Iver. Here he quotes as the question, is there a prohibition of lifnei iver? So what is the pasuk? Lifnei iver lo titen michshol, not to put a stumbling block before somebody who's blind. Is there a prohibition of lifnei iver lahazmin anashim sheyavo litpalel b'shabbat lebeit hakneset kishayodeya sheyichalelu shabbat b'nesiyah b'mishines? Is there a problem of inviting somebody? Come to the shul, come to daven, come to the shul, when you know that they're going to drive. V'ishavti, and I responded, v'lahazmin et harechokim ba'ofen she'i efshar she'avo b'lo chilul shabbat vaday asur. To invite somebody when there is no alternative to their driving is certainly prohibited. V'hu od garua mi'isur lifnei iver. So now Rav Moshe says, okay, you asked me about lifnei iver, guess what? It's worse than lifnei iver. Shrehu od bi'isur mesit. That what you are is a mesit. Now, does anybody in here know what a mesit is? Does not sound good, but do you know what it is? A mesit. What? An insider. A mesit is only found in the Torah and in the Gemara, as far as I know, regarding avodah zarah. It's somebody who incites another person to do avodah zarah. So over here, Rav Moshe just now pulled out the most potent weapon. You know, if I were to make a continuum on Jews, right? So I have a tzaddik. What do you have after a tzaddik? An almost tzaddik? A wannabe tzaddik? A failed tzaddik? Right? What? Tzaddik? Tzaddik yisod olam, tzaddik yisod olam atachton, right? So where do you put the person next after the tzaddik? So actually in halacha, you have something which is, you have uneducated, somebody who just doesn't know the halacha. So I think that's a real important category to book. And then afterwards you have somebody who I would call which is most religious Jews, and I'm sorry for saying this, is called a mumar l'teavon. Somebody who occasionally breaks laws because they have, they're weak. They know they shouldn't do this, but they're weak. They know it's Lashon Hara, but no. They know that. Now, yes, is that fair, or is that completely unfair what I said? What? Is it fair or is it not fair? It's not nice, but is it fair? You, again, tzaddik, somebody who keeps everything. By the way, does such a person exist? No. Right, nobody keeps everything. So now the person who doesn't keep everything, why did not keep everything? So one possibility is they don't know, and you should learn more, but you don't know. And what's the other possibility? You're weak. But that's a mumar l'teavon. The reason that you're weak is because you give in to your, l'teavon literally means desire. You give in to your yetzahara occasionally. What's the next thing after a mumar l'teavon? Then there's something which is called a mumar l'hachis. L'hachis. Somebody who breaks the Torah deliberately, on purpose, because they want to get God angry. So what would be the difference between those two? The mumar l'teavon would be, let's say that there's two pizza stores. One is kosher, one is not kosher. One costs more money, one costs less money. One tastes better, one tastes worse. So in this example, the one that tastes better and is cheaper is the non-kosher one. And if you even want a little bit more, and they're also not so close to one another, and you're right in front of that non-kosher one, and you give and you eat it. It's not you want to get God angry. It's that you got momentarily weak, and you say, well, okay, you know what? Maybe the cheese is kosher anyway, and maybe this is kosher, maybe that is kosher, whatever, and you make up whatever excuse, but it's a mumar l'teavon. On the other hand, what's a mumar l'hachis? Again, I really want to be extreme. That the kosher one is the cheaper one and the better one, but you don't want to pay money to Jews. You don't want Jews to make you don't want to give money to those kind of people. You want lahachis. You don't want something kosher. You don't want to pay the kosher tax. If you look on anti-Semitic websites, you'll find that they believe there's something called the kosher tax, which kosher food and non-kosher food are exactly the same, but the kosher tax gives money to Jews when they declare something kosher. And the whole thing is a scam just to give more money to Jews. By the way, generally, if you're ever depressed, you should read anti-Semitic websites, because according to them, we control the world. I mean, this is like an old joke: is it better to read a Jewish newspaper or an anti-Semitic newspaper? The Jewish newspapers complain, "Oh, this is a problem, and that's a problem, and this is falling apart." And then you read the non-Jewish: we control Wall Street, we control Hollywood, we control all of the press, we control everything. So therefore, we should definitely read all the anti-Semitic, because it'll make you feel better. Okay. And there's a Jewish tax, which is making us all rich. That's the other thing you should know, is that we're all currently getting rich right now because of the Jewish tax. Okay. But then there's something worse. I forgot. I had to continue my continuum, right? That's why it's a continuum. So we had our tzaddik, who doesn't exist. We have our doesn't know everything. Mumar l'teavon. Mumar l'hachis. What's next? After mumar l'hachis, I mean, what else can you be? Mesid. The mesid is a, what would the word be? A missionary. The mesid is the missionary trying to get you to do avodah zarah. So look what Rav Moshe just now did. He said, you asked me a question, Rabbi Kalbach, whether inviting somebody who may have to drive on Shabbat to come to shul, if I'm breaking a halacha of Lefnei Iver, and Rav Moshe says, Lefnei Iver, of course it's Lefnei Iver, but I think it's worse than that. I think you're a mesid. I think that you are like a missionary to get somebody to break Shabbat if you do this. By the way, the first huge question that comes out on this, which we would like to ask Rav Moshe, is there such a thing as a missionary to break Shabbat? Is that real? Or is that Lefnei Iver? Which means, how do you know that there's this other category? Can you please show me where there's this other source that it's called Mesit by other cases? Elisheva. So that's good, because he so far has been dealing with the case where they have to break it, and therefore by you inviting, you're making them break it, and therefore by encouraging them to do this, you're mesid. So what happens when the case is not exactly this? What happens when there are other options? What happens when you invite them to stay over, and so on? Right, so I'm saying all of that is not mentioned over here, but I just want you to recognize, in the first tshuva, Rav Moshe said this is absolutely wrong, and you are causing somebody to sin, and you're not doing chinuch. Again, he's not telling him. He's saying if the community does this, it's not chinuch for tefillah, it's chinuch for chilul Shabbat. So now you realize that in his earlier tshuva, he actually went much further. And what did he say in the early tshuva? He said that if you invite them, you're asking if they're guilty of lifnei iver, guess what? I think that they're guilty of being a mesit. Va'av she'isser mesit l'chiyuv skila, who rak mesit la'avod avodet kochavim, mikol makom le'inyan isur va'onish klapei shmaya, b'kol ha'chomer she'ein tonin l'mesit, yesh b'kol ha'isurim kimufurash be'sanhedrin. So now you see, he did bring a source, and what is his source? He brings the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which I'll get to you in a sec, we'll read it in a second, we'll continue what his source is. But he says that it's true that we only find a mesit regarding avodah zarah regarding the punishment, but he says you could be a mesit for all sins, and what's his proof? As it says in Sanhedrin, she'elef Rav Shimon bar Nachman, Amar Rav Yochanan, minayin she'ein tonin lemesit, how do you know that you don't bring an argument for a mesit? So let me explain to you. The Gemara tells you that anybody who is guilty of a death penalty, you would then open up the discussion if anybody afterwards said, listen, maybe they're extenuating circumstances and want to give a further argument. The exception that you don't learn any zchut once they're found is a mesit. A mesit, there's no arguments. So he says, and where do we learn this law about the mesit that you don't get any arguments? So he says, because he learns it, menachash hakadmoni, af shelo yachotei avodah zarah, ela isur achilat me'etz hadat. Now, this is a very funny proof. Do you all understand why this is a funny proof? You learn from it. The Gemara says, oh, how do you learn? But again, is this Agadah or is this Halacha? Is this, and by the way, to say, well, what did the Nachash do? The Nachash, which chelik of Shulchan Aruch did the Nachash tell you to break? He goes, Yeridea, eating something which wasn't kosher. Maybe it was a little more than that. I mean, it was like total defiance of God. And if you eat this, you'll be like God. One second. If you eat this, you'll be like God. There are arguments that one could put forth and say, excuse me, the Nachash was guilty of hasata for Avodah Zarah and trying to turn Adam into a god. I mean, what exactly is this? But Rav Moshe is fascinating because he says, no, this is a mesit, and let me prove it to you, it's a mesit, because the Nachash is called a mesit. And the Nachash was only telling to eat from a tree that you couldn't eat from. So far, we're like halfway into two tshuvot. I know, I'm just saying is that one could certainly discuss this as proof. And listen, in all issues, and this is generally in intellectual pursuits, what we learn to do is to see a person's statement or conclusion, and then we see their evidence. And then you judge the evidence and see, is this the correct conclusion? Is it the only conclusion? Does it back it up? And the first tshuva was great because there was no evidence. Oh, you think you're doing good, you're doing something bad. That's not... One second. As far as a posek getting up and saying, this is what you should do, we have to then question, so what exactly does it mean when, again, I can open up all of Rav Moshe's tshuvot and measure them in terms of how many words were used and judge this one compared, what do you think we're going to find? That this is going to be among the shorter tshuvot that he writes. By the way, the other exception would be when he's asked like 10 questions in a row, like from one person, then he has like some short responses to them. But this is a very short tshuva with no evidence. The second one, now we started the evidence, but the evidence has not blown you away yet. And he actually said something which is really fascinating, that you could be a mesit for other things, not just for Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is only to get the full punishment of skilah if you try to get someone to do Avodah Zarah, so therefore it's an extension of Avodah Zarah. But the concept of mesit works by everything else, and the proof is the nachash. So it's that last step that, you know, we pause a little bit, but you know what? I will tell you one thing. I'm aware of probably another 10 rabbis who have approached this topic. Not one of them took the mesit argument in. No, nobody else took that in. Nobody else said, hold it, but you're a mesit if you do this. So if all the other poskim who've gone down this road have not chosen to use this argument, so maybe that tells you something as well. There's a book that was recently written. I just forgot the name of it. It's like this thick, and somebody responds to Rav Moshe on each tshuva that he wrote and brings like all the discussions, which means how did people respond to Rav Moshe? So in this one, he does mention that nobody, I mean, other people agree, disagree, whatever, but nobody else uses the mesit argument. And he actually quoted somebody on this who wrote a book about Kiruv Rechokim, who I asked him if he can send me the tshuva, which he did, and he told me where I could find it, and he had no idea that this other fellow had quoted him. And then I told him what I think, but you don't know what I think yet, so we'll have to wait for that. Yes? And you're questioning why is this. So hold on for one more minute. Let's continue in his discussion over here. We've seen, therefore, that there's mesit for every sin. That anybody who's guilty of being a mesit for other things, they will be punished by heaven, and which is also quite interesting. The iser lifnei iver. So now we're going back to the lifnei iver, which was actually the question: are you guilty of putting a stumbling block in front of somebody when you invite them to come to shul, which is his case? The iser lifnei iver yesh af be'enim rechokim kolkach kishyedua shiit atzlu lelech beraglayim v'yasu b'mishins aval iser metit leka be'enim rechokim. So let's try that again. The iser lifnei iver yesh af be'enim rechokim kolkach kishyedua shiit atzlu. So he just now said there's two cases. One is a case of somebody who lives close by and could walk, but will end up driving. And the other person who lives far and can't walk and will end up driving. Are they both the same case? So again, the iser lifnei iver yesh af be'enim rechokim kolkach kishyedua shiit atzlu lech beraglayim v'yasu b'mishins. So therefore, it's lifnei iver if you know that this person is going to end up getting in the car. It doesn't make a difference they live close. They're going to get in the car, so then you're guilty of lifnei iver. Aval iser mesit leka be'enim rechokim. Nonetheless, if they're close by, you're not a mesit. By the way, why exactly that would be the distinction, it's not clear. What if you didn't invite them? Rather, you made an announcement. There's going to be a minyan, and we're giving out prizes to the kids in order to bring the kids here. What if you never invited them, but you just publicized there's going to be a minyan, which is he feels, if you tell somebody, listen, we're having a minyan, and you know the guy's going to get in the car, and he lives far away, he says, then you're a mesit, and it's lifnei iver. If the guy lives close by, you're not a mesit, but you still get lifnei iver. But if you just inform them, then he says, then you're not a mesid, because you're not enticing them. You're not. But maybe it's still lufne even. V'tzrichim l'faresh lo yitnu prasim ella le'elu she'avo b'raglayim b'heter. He goes, this is what your shul should do. Only give the prizes to the kids who walk to shul, and don't give any prizes to the kids who were driven to shul. Ubidavar shirotza l'histalek miliot member chaver b'beit hakneset shirbeim palim sham ein min agim kshura. Whether it is wise for you to stay as a member of the shul or to leave because other people are not doing as they should. My sense of Moshe says is that you shouldn't leave, that there should be somebody there who tells them what's right. And don't give up and say they're not going to listen. Right? I guess you're a little surprised to find that in the middle of a tshuva from Rav Moshe, because a little bit of light can extinguish a great deal of darkness. And maybe your protest is going to work regarding a lot of prohibitions. As long as the Beit Knesset is acting in a proper manner. I'll come back to this line in a moment. But if it comes to a situation that they remove the mechitza, so now you understand what kishura means. Kishura means as long as there's still a mechitza. But if they take the mechitza down, or if they change the liturgy, the prayers or the Kriyat Torah, michuyavim ko yirei Hashem listalek miliyot members sham Moshe Feinstein. So actually the last line was the most interesting and the most important of the whole thing, because what he finally revealed his hand. So what is it? What is bothering him in this whole issue? And what's the line? What's the red line over here? Well, we didn't understand. I have to read between the lines. What's the red line? The red line is, if the shul becomes a conservative shul, then you have to leave. If it's an Orthodox shul, you can stay. So what's the difference between a conservative shul and an Orthodox shul? An Orthodox shul is one that has a mechitza and the davening is traditional. The conservative shul is where they remove the mechitza or they change the davening. They no longer say musaf because they don't believe in korbanot. They change the Kriyat Torah from the traditional to some reform shuls changed it some changed to the triennial cycle where they finished the Torah every 3 years, which was actually the original minhag in Eretz Israel. So he says, they start changing the davening, changing the Kriyat Torah, changing the liturgy. At that point, you can't stay there anymore. So Rav Moshe's line now is very, very clear. What's his line? His line is, if it's an Orthodox shul, you can stay in it. If it's a conservative shul, you can't stay in it. Very simple. By the way, he was not the only one who went in this direction. Rav Soloveitchik was asked, and I say this from memory, so I hope I'm not wrong, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. Is it better to go to a conservative shul and hear the shofar being blown on Rosh Hashanah, or to stay at home and daven without a minyan and not to hear the shofar being blown? So he said, better to stay at home and not to hear the shofar than to hear a shofar in a conservative shul. Now, Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Feinstein were, compared to many, many other people in the American scene, were relatively moderate. So what is it? So would it surprise you to find out that in 1950, the conservative had a halachic meeting and decision that everybody is allowed to drive to shul? The prohibition to driving to shul has now been removed, and they considered it to be pikuach nefesh, and will lose Jewish community if we don't allow people to drive to shul. So now you're allowed to drive to shul. Now, here's why I say, with a little bit of hesitancy and trepidation, is it possible that Rav Moshe's response over here is a response to the conservative movement? Which means, is this idea of driving to shul, has that now become, and I said a red line before, has that now become a red flag for Rav Moshe? So somebody to ask him in the 50s, well, what do you think? Should we encourage people to come who'll drive to shul? No, because that just now became part of the conservative psak. And once it's become, and more than that, part of the wrong conservative psak. and therefore you think you're saving the religion by doing this, you're destroying the religion by doing this. Now notice, in both of these examples, as far as we can tell, he's talking about Orthodox shuls. But he's talking about Orthodox shuls, and what you may not like, because people hate these arguments, are we dealing with a slippery slope argument? That if I allow this, then what goes next? Or what goes next in order to make people more involved? But I will say that Rav Moshe has two interesting tshuvot here. There is a minimal amount of discussion in terms of the halakha itself. In the first one, almost nothing, just going on this. Oh, you think you're bringing them closer, you think you're being mechanich them for tefillah, you're being mechanich them for chilul Shabbat. So again, part of what I have to ask is, and this is all what's unfair, so what brought Rav Moshe to be so strong? So I'll say it again. The acknowledgement that the conservative movement, and here's something that maybe you don't know. The conservative movement was not always the conservative movement. The conservative movement in America began as a response against the reform that they thought went too far. The main organization, I don't want to say organization, the main institution of the conservative movement is the Jewish Theological Seminary, JTS. In the mid-1920s or late 1920s, JTS and what later became YU almost merged. And the main reason they didn't merge was not necessarily about hashkafa or halakha. There may have been one particular teacher they wanted fired, or there may have been, but as I said, they almost merged. The fact that there was a havamin and there were discussions itself, I think, should be interesting. The OU, which is, this is totally hilarious, the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America originally was part of JTS, was part of that movement, and then, you know, the world aligns itself in different ways at different times. And when you say that somebody may have been a rabbi in a conservative shul in 1920, it may not mean the same thing as in 1950, and it may not mean the same thing in 1980 or the year 2000, because things change. There, by the way, were Orthodox shuls, part of the OU, part of the Orthodox Union, without a mechitza as recently as 5 years ago. And they were Orthodox shuls, but they didn't have mechitza. So you're going to say, but how could there be an Orthodox shul without a mechitza? Okay, they didn't have mechitza. But why would they even hold on to them? Well, just realize something. If they're an Orthodox shul, the sitter they're going to use will be an Orthodox sitter and not a sitter that changes things. If they're part of the Orthodox community, then the movement for kids will be NCSY as opposed to USY, which then again could make a difference in what kind of camps they go to in summer and so on and so forth. But as much as the world today has really gone in different directions, it wasn't always like that. And one of the things that happened is, one, the conservative movement took down the mechitzas or allowed each shul to vote on it to decide what they want to do in that shul, and most of them took down the mechitza. The other thing is that they passed this law that you're able to drive to shul, and drive to shul is okay. At the time they did it, they said you could drive to shul and no place else. I think if you were to ask most conservative Jews today, they would tell you they drive every place but not to shul. And I don't say that, I'm really not saying that to be cynical. I'm just saying is that what filtered down to them is that you're allowed to drive on Shabbat. That the rabbi drives, they drive, we can drive. Of course you could drive on Shabbat, but the going to shul became more difficult. I mean, if I had a critique, it would be a completely different critique. My critique would be that if you allow people to drive to shul, then you're telling them when you buy a house, you don't have to buy your house in a Jewish community. Then you're telling them, because once you get in a car, what difference does it make if you drive for 10 minutes or 20 minutes? Right? So therefore, if somebody lives 20 minutes away from the Jewish community, so then when the kids are going to school, what kind of school they're going to, what kind of friends they're going to have? Which means in order to save Judaism and let them drive to shul, you're actually going to end up causing there to be far more intermarriage because your kid's not growing up with Jewish neighbors, Jewish friends, or Jewish community. So these things are not as simple as just saying the kid could drive. By the way, there was in a journal called Tradition in the early 80s, I believe it was 82, there was a symposium on Orthodoxy, and Rabbi Lichtenstein, who was always very careful in the way that he said things, so I don't have the exact quote, so please, I apologize. If you want, I can get you the exact quote that he said. But he said it the other way around. He said, I would not want to be the person who told the marginal Jew, and he had some alliteration, maybe it was Dallas and some other place that rhymed with Dallas, not to drive to go to shul on Shabbos if this was their only connection with Judaism. By the way, you notice what he said? He didn't say, I would say yes. He just said, I wouldn't want to be the one to say no. Because essentially we're dealing with Jewish identity. But by the way, the real issue over here, I want to qualify it. The real issue is there are extreme cases in Judaism. The question is, should the extreme become the mainstream? So generally what the conservative movement did in their psak was, they would take extreme situations and then turn the extreme into the mainstream. And therefore, again, if one person lived miles and miles from a shul and says, you know, is this okay for me to drive? As I said, Rav Lichtenstein dealt with the opposite. Maybe I wouldn't tell them not to, which is not the same thing as telling them to, but versus saying to everybody, of course, the port, it's okay. You're allowed to drive. And there are cases that one would be tempted, again, don't want to go too far right now, but there are cases that maybe are the extreme cases. And what we need to do right now is to go back to explore a little bit more about the situation of what exactly is Lifnei Iver. So let's go and proceed. Because this is what Moshe didn't do. He didn't say, okay, let's analyze Lifnei Iver and let's see why this is Lifnei Iver. So let's take a look. Source number 3 is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. Minayim shelo yoshit adam kos shel yayim l'nazir ve'eiver menachay l'bnei Noach. So what is he opposing? You should not take wine and give it to a Nazir. Why shouldn't you take wine and give it to a Nazir? Nazir is not allowed to drink wine. So if he can't drink wine, is this my problem? Am I allowed to serve a Nazir wine? So again, how do I know that I shouldn't give a Nazir wine? And the other case is actually more interesting, because talking to non-Jew, ve'ever min hachay levnei Noach. How do I know I'm allowed to give a non-Jew ever min hachay? Talmud lomar, ve'lefnei iver lo titein michshol. V'ha'ha'cha dichi lo yavinen lei, shekol yi'u, v'kav avr mishum lefnei iver lo titein michshol, ha'bait emu deka betrei avri nahara. So without going into every word, I want to explain the conclusion of the Gemara. The Gemara doesn't say in every single case you're going to be guilty of Lifnei Iver. The Gemara actually says something quite extreme. To be Lifnei Iver, it needs to be a case, and the important thing is the Kai betray Avre Nahara. You're dealing with two sides of a river. Let's look at Rashi. Rashi's interesting because he explains it with the example of the non-Jew. You know, God forbid, should a Jew sin, but, you know, give the wine to the Nazir. The kaima betray avri nahara. We're talking about two sides of a river. Oved kochavim mitzad zeh, v'Yisrael mitzad zeh. V'adai lo yirlei lo motzi shakel, which means, if you did not bring him the avri menachai, he does not have access to any. Which means the Gemara's conclusion is, when is it considered to be lifnei iver? Let me put it like this. Let's just say that you're not allowed to smoke. Why would I possibly say you're not allowed to smoke? Because it's really bad for you, right? It will kill you, statistically, not individually, which is the whole problem. No one ever died smoking a cigarette, unless they got hit by something or whatever, right? What I'm saying, that's the logics. No one ever died smoking a cigarette, but they tend to do really bad things to many parts of your body. So smoking cigarettes is bad. So am I allowed to sell cigarettes? By selling cigarettes, am I guilty of Lifnei Iver? I'm breaking halacha because I'm causing somebody. So the answer would be two sides of the river. If there's nobody else selling cigarettes, and the only way this person can get a cigarette is me, so then I'm breaking Lifnei Iver. If there's another kiosk every single block and you can get cigarettes any place that you want, the Gemara's conclusion is that's not Lifnei Iver, because you're not placing the stumbling block, you're facilitating. You're not the reason they're smoking. I know you can argue with me and say, no, the only reason smoking, you get no. But if you didn't give it to them, there are 10 other places they could have gotten it from. So in such cases, it's not Lifnei Iver, which means the Gemara just now helped us redefine what Lifnei Iver is. How should we now say it? It is causing somebody to sin. Not facilitating, but causing somebody to sin. which means without you they could not have sinned. By the way, you know what our problem is going to be now? Going back to Rav Moshe. Without you, they could not have sinned. Which means, if Rav Moshe actually would have quoted the... Right, like nobody would sin unless there was a minion in a shul inviting kids to come on Shabbat. Like nobody else would have ever sinned. So when you start thinking about it, you say, hold it a second. Is it, yeah, he said this is Lifnei Iver, and this is a Mesit. By the way, why is it a Mesit? It's amazing because it's Lifnei Iver. If it wasn't Lifnei Iver, am I right about this? Or am I wrong about this? Why was it amazing? Because you're causing to break Shabbat. Why are you causing to break Shabbat? Because you're guilty of Lifnei Iver. Maybe I'm wrong about this. But I think that his whole case builds on Lifnei Iver. But why exactly is this Lifnei Iver? Parenthetically, source number 5 was the proof that he brought regarding the Nachash. Gemara in Sanhedrin. Amr of Shema ben Nachman of Yonatan. How do you know that you're not allowed to put an argument forth to defend the Mesid? Minachash HaKadmoni. Minachash HaRishon, as it were. The Amar Rabbi, it should be Smalai. Harbe ta'anot haya lo l'nachash l'ton v'lo ta'an. The Nachash had a lot of arguments he could have put forth. Again, once you have a talking snake, so who knows what he could have said. B'mema lo ta'an lo Kadosh Baruch. Why didn't God then give any of the defenses? Lafi Shelo ta'anhu, may have a little memory. So what do we learn from that God didn't give arguments? Because basically, divrei harav, divrei hatama, divrei mishomim, divrei rav shomim, which goes back to this point in terms of you never should have listened to the Nachash, but let's just leave, this is, goes more to the point of why there's no shleich levar vera, but that was the Gemara that he quoted, which again I'm going to say is just a little funny that we're going to use this in terms of a halachic basis. Look at Tosfot in source number 6. Ve'im tomer v'holka avar alifnei iv lo titein mechshol. Afilu marisha ha'i yochol itzlo. Afilu lo ha'i b'yado d'lo avar mishum lifnei iv. V'demoshe kos. Yai l'nazir muki lo perakam l'kov r'chavim d'kai betray avre d'nahara. Mikol makom isur d'rabonin mihaika shechayev l'afrisho me isur. So, what if I hand the Nachash, the Nazir. What if I hand the Nazir a cup of wine? Am I guilty of Lifnei Iver? So what's the answer going to be? Well, what if there are 7 wine stores on this block and I sell him the wine? Am I guilty of Lifnei Iver? It goes back to my cigarette question. Am I guilty of Lifnei Iver? So there's no. But now, Tosfot added another point. Maybe there is, not maybe. The Torah is saying there's a rabbinic law that you're breaking what is. Don't we have an obligation of stopping somebody from breaking the law? So therefore, if I am going to facilitate him to drink it, I'm not guilty of lifnei iver, of a Torah level law, but maybe there's still going to be a prohibition here because I'm not preventing the person from breaking the law. Rashi, commenting on the Gemara in Gittin, says, and forget about the context, you're not allowed to help somebody sin. But by the way, he did qualify the little bit. His qualification is you can't help them bishat haveira while they're sinning itself. So I want to pause over here for a second. This is something which is called misayeya lidei over haveira. I think we can translate it as aiding and abetting a sinner. So there's one category which we're going to say is lifnei iver, placing a stumbling block in front of someone who's blind. But then there's a second category which is called aiding, helping somebody sin. Helping somebody sin is also a drabanan. Now it's interesting because Tosfot and Rashi have 2 different ways, one positive, one negative. Tosfot says, but there should still be an idea of preventing somebody from sinning. Rashi says, but there's still a rabbinic law that you should not help somebody sin. It's called misayeya lidei ovrei avera. So therefore, even when there is an absence of a Torah-level law, which we can all be surprised now to have learned, that the Torah-level law of lifnei iver is only if there's 2 sides of the river, which really is quite extreme, so maybe there's still a rabbinic level. Now, again, I'm going to point out that Rav Moshe just did not go into any of this discussion, but rather, what did Rav Moshe do? Rav Moshe said that, you think this is chinuch for tefillah? No, it's chinuch for breaking Shabbat. You think, the other one is, you think it's lifnei iver, it's worse than lifnei iver, it's actually a mesit over here, because you're causing the person to sin. But when we start looking at, okay, but what exactly is lifnei iver? So now we are somewhat confused. And by the way, notice this other thing in Rashi, because I don't want you to let go of this so quickly. What is miseyeya? She'asur l'seyeya b'yadayim idei avre avira bishat ha'avira. Did that just now qualify it even more? What does bishat avira mean? Is it, I mean, what can't I do? Is it that I can't sell the wine to the Nazir? Or I can't pour him the cup? Right? No, but I'm being serious about the distinction. According to this, I mean, let's not be so... I'm saying, let's not be so quick. What, am I not allowed to sell wine to a Nazir based on this? No. I could sell wine to a Nazir based on what Rashi is saying. Why? By the way, just because I sell wine to a Nazir, does that mean that he's going to sin? So it's interesting, because the two sides of the river, I'm guilty. Why it's lifnei iver? Why is it lifnei iver? And I have to add something. It must be because he desires to drink it. Okay, that has to be a part of it. But over here, Rashi says, no, there's still a rabbinic law, but the rabbinic law he just now qualified is aiding and abetting, but it has to be b'shat avira. It's not just like somehow, you know, for example, if I sell cars, can I not sell car to a mechalel Shabbat? Because he's going to drive the car on Shabbat? Okay, so no, just so help me now. Is it lifnei iver?
No.
Why not? You can buy from anyone. Is it mesayei l'dei over avira? Right. Now, what if somebody, I invite to come for Shabbat, and they say, I can't get there. He says, here, take my car keys. Come, you can use my car. Is that lifnei iver? That could be lifnei iver. Yeah, that could be lifnei iver. I like that much more in terms of lifnei iver, because why? Because I'm giving them my car keys, and because they, I mean, that may be much closer to the two sides of the river. I can't get there. I have no way of getting there. Oh, so here, take my car, and come drive over Shabbat morning, and then I'll see you. So that, but by the way, you noticed how extreme I just now got? How extreme of an example that was? That was not the same thing as inviting somebody. It was not the same thing as having a, what was the case that he was dealing with? Can we advertise or invite a kid and tell a kid that there's going to be a minyan on Shabbat and they're giving out prizes? He says, don't give out prizes. Only give to the kid who walked. Don't give to the kid who drives. So, I would have liked Rav Moshe to go and contend with some of the sources that we have in front of us, because at least at our first looking at this, do the sources back him up? Which means, does the lifnei iver discussion back up what Rav Moshe is saying? Take a look at source number 12. It's the Rambam in Laws of Rotseach Ushmira Tanefesh, murder and preservation of life. Kol sha'asur lemkor la'akum, asur lemkor li'Yisrael shehu listin. Talking about selling arms. Many Israelis make money as arms dealers. Are you allowed to sell arms? Are you allowed to be an arms dealer? So he says, asur lemkor, right? Anything you can't sell to a non-Jew, and by the way, the assumption over here is the non-Jew is going to be using them not in kosher ways, using the arms. You can't sell to a Jew who's a criminal. So you can sell arms to a Jew who's a police officer. You can sell it to a Jew who is somebody who's honest and wants to protect their home. You can sell it to somebody who's going to use it in a legal way. But you can't sell arms to somebody who's a criminal. Shenimtza machziki de ovri avera umachshilo. By the way, so which category did he just now use? Did he use lifnei iver? Did he use helping, aiding, and abetting? Which one was it? Lifnei iver or aiding and abetting? It was aiding and abetting. Why is it not lifnei iver? It goes back to the three sides of the river. So now again, I think what you're realizing that you, and I'll say this again, you may not have realized before we started, that lifnei iver has a much more narrow definition than maybe we ever appreciated before. So what I'm saying, if you sell arms to non-Jews who we suspect of using them in nefarious ways, or Jews who we suspect of nefarious ways, he says that's shenim tzemach ziki de over vira umach shilo. V'chein kol amach shil iver b'davar v'hisiu eitza she'inu hogenet o she'chizek de over vira shehu iver v'inu re'ed derech hamet b'bnei ta'avat libo hareza over b'lo tasei shenema v'lifnei ivelo titein michshol habal litom umcha eitza ten lo eitza hogenet lo. Now, I want to pause here for a second, because the Rambam just now did something interesting, and I want to show you what he did. Go back to source number 9. Lo tichalel cheresh, v'lo ivo lo titin mikshov, v'fi yoreitim elokech ani Hashem. Okay, that's the pasuk, that's the source, Parshat Kedoshim. The Sifra says, Sifra is the Torah Kohanim, the Midrash Halacha on the pasuk. Let's look at Rashi first, but then we'll go backwards. Rashi writes in 11, what does it mean that somebody who's blind, somebody who's relatively blind, somebody who doesn't understand this particular thing, to give somebody inappropriate advice? Don't tell him, listen, if I were you, I'd get rid of that field and buy a donkey instead. And why did you give this advice? Because you want to buy the field. So you give him great business advice. Sell the field, but why are you giving him that advice? Because you want to buy the field. Now let's go back to his source, which is the Sifra. What if somebody asks you, can this girl marry a Kohen? Don't say something's allowed when it's not allowed. Someone comes for advice. Don't give him advice which is not appropriate. Don't say get up early in the morning when you know the guy can get robbed in the morning. Lest you come and say, but I thought I was giving him good advice. You know what was inside your heart. So it says, fear God. So if you go back to the pasuk, now notice that Rashi ignored the discussion about the rivers, the two sides of the river, and giving the Nazir wine or so on, and he goes straight to this interpretation. Right? Don't give a guy bad advice. Why did Rashi prefer this? So my guess is because he was concerned with the end of the pasuk. We're not dealing with a case which is objective. What's an objective case? Giving wine to the Nazir. Objective, that's not allowed. You two sides of the river, he couldn't have sinned without you. That's the Neiver. But there's no Yireite Lokecha there. In this case that he preferred to use in his commentary from the Sifra, because you could say, okay, I told the guy to sell the field. I thought it was a good idea to sell the field. Listen, you know what's really in your heart. If your whole motivation over here was to sell the field because you wanted to get in that field, so then you're breaking Lifnei Iver. And I think that Rashi brings this interpretation because it works in the Pasuk better. And that's what Rashi's doing in his Perush on the Torah. But now you notice that the Rambam brings this as well as being part of the Torah law, giving bad advice. Where we question regarding selling arms to the Jew or non-Jew, because that sounds like machzik yidei ovar ve'ra, but when he talks about giving bad advice, that he went back to lifnei iver. Okay. Source number 8, Shulchan Aruch, Laws of Idolatry. The Rama writes, "V'dafka l'kohen l'avod kochavim shechazku sheyaktir l'vana l'avod kochavim aval estamud chachamim shari yesh omer hada asur l'mkor lehem dvarim ashayachim l'avodatam, that which you're not allowed to sell to an idolater, something they're going to use in their service, haynu dafka im ein lehem acherim kiyotzei bo o shelo yuchlu knop b'makom acher." Let's say a non-Jew is going to use wine in a church as part of the sacrament. This is part of their, I'm going to call it avodah zarah right now. Are you allowed to sell it to them? So what did the Rama rule? He said it only applies if they couldn't get it from someplace else. How does he know that? You all know how he knows that. How does he know it? What's he using here? The logic of two sides of the river. So the Rama rules like the Mordechai. If they can buy it someplace else, it is allowed. By the way, it's interesting. What happened to Lisaye Livne Over Vera? So I'm skipping a little bit, but it could be that it was exactly like Rashi implied. What was the implication of Rashi? It's only Misayeya if it's right now they're going to sin. But if they're not going to sin right now, then there's no Drabanan either. So now what are you surprised with, or maybe not surprised? That's the Psak in the Shulchan Aruch. That's how the Rama rules. V'yesh machmirin. There's some who are more machmir. V'nogu l'hakak asfara rishona. V'kol bal nefesh yachmir l'atzmo. So don't you love it when he goes back and forth there? Halacha, you're allowed to sell it. Want to be machmir? Be machmir. But what did we just now see implemented in the Shulchan Aruch? Everything that we've learned so far. Lifne'iver is only if it's two sides of a river. Misayeya is only if it's immediate. If it's not immediate, if it's not two sides of the river, it is mutar. So now, does my question or of Moshe get a little stronger now? Instead of saying, but why didn't you explain to us why this is Lifnei Iver? Which means there happens to be a sugya called Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Mechshol, and how does this actually stand up to it? Let's look at the Shach in Source 13. Going on that point, Yesh Omrim, Desirulan Dechi Hechid Amrinim B'Shas Gabe Nazir Da Asaloshit Lokos Yayin Dehainu Dafka. When does it say can't you cannot give a Nazir? Dafka Bekai Betray Avri Denare. Only with these two sides of river. Do a Din Hacha V'Yesh Machrim V'Servim Dekom Makim Yisurdu Rabbananika. And some say no. There's also rabbinic law. Afil Lo Avi Kamotresh Avri Denare V'Kol Zeladat Harav. According to the Mechaber. Which is interesting, he said, that, and a whole other consideration we never thought about. This idea of Misayeya, the Shach is telling us, only applies by Jews. It does not apply by non-Jews. There's no Misayeya there. Either it's Lifnei or not. There's no rabbinic law of Misayeya. But he just now added another thing in. There's also no Misayeya by a mumar, by a Jew who's non-religious. I'm just using that term right now. He goes, the whole idea of misayeya is you're helping them sin. But what if somebody always sins? If somebody's a habitual sinner, you're not helping them sin. They're sinners. Which means the Mordechai, or who he's quoting here, or the Shach, is saying, can you stop and think for a second? The Torah law is only if they couldn't sin without you. The rabbinic law is if right now you're helping them sin. But he goes, that's only by a case where a person normally doesn't sin. If a person is a sinner, they're going to sin, right? Should be like a song, sinners are going to sin, right? You're not making them sin. So he says, therefore, there's no isur by somebody who is a mumar. So that just now also took us to another place. And he says it again a couple of lines later. You know, you should separate them, like Rashi had said, you should separate them. He goes, no. That's only by, should we skip a little bit? Shukhayat HaFrisha Me'isur Kedivar Rosh Shom Delogor Me'isur Katan Ochen Ve'ed Shebeitim Metzuvan HaFrisha Kol She'en Yisur Gadol Ma'asha'en Kein Ba'ovid Kachavim Yisur Mumar She'en Uchayiv LaHaFrisha. There's no obligation to separate a sinner from sinning because they normally sin. I know that then all of it may have sounded a little bit ironic or funny. So I want to pause here and we're going to stop here. And all that I'm going to warn you about is, what did we do so far and what do we still need to do? What we did so far is I raised a question. And the question I raised was a very narrow question. Can you invite somebody to come? Because you know that there's going to be other levels of the question. Can I invite somebody Friday night where they don't have to sin to get there? They'll get there before Shabbat. You all realize I can offer them a place to stay. They may not choose to accept it. They may then get in their car. So am I really going to be guilty of Lifnei Iver, of Misayeya, of not being my Frisho Tamei Aveira? Do I need to grab the keys from them? I mean, meaning, what exactly is going to be the halacha in all of these cases? So I think that what we've seen so far has been interesting, and you realize why there is a huge, what we can call petach, or opening right here. Because Rav Moshe, in his two tshuvot, said, like, what are you talking about? Of course not. And this is a Mesit and this is Lifnei Iver. Of course it is. But when we actually learned through the laws of Lifnei Iver, let's just put it this way, have I successfully taken to the case that none of you are at all convinced that it's Lifnei Iver at this point? Because why is this Lifnei Iver? Why am I the only way that this person can actually sin? And without us inviting this kid to come to the shul, they would be keeping Shabbat, you know, till Rabbeinu Tam afterwards, and you know, eating only food which is kosher with, you know, Chazon Ish. And so, meaning that that's not exactly the case. And all of that is bringing us to wonder. And I go back to what I said in my introduction, that to what extent did the fact that Rav Moshe was dealing with a conservative movement, which right then had encouraged people to drive to shul on Shabbat, to what extent did that then cause him to say, well, absolutely not, and that therefore became a red line for him. So what's going to be interesting now? What's going to happen when we now move over? I want to go to two other continents. So we're going to see how much more time this will take me, 1 more week or 2 more weeks. I want to move over to Israel, and what's going to happen, where everything becomes more contentious, and we're going to see how Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach dealt with this. And I want to go to South Africa, and we're going to see how Rav Sternbach dealt with this. So we have 2 more places to go in terms of tshuvot, but so far what we've done is seen Rav Moshe's very strong tshuvot with very little argumentation to back it up, and then what we've seen is the actual sugya, and we're left someplace unconvinced. But the main chidush that I still want to tell you, we're hiding for next week, but I will just say this one thing. To what extent are the two types of Lifnei Iver the same? Because we saw 2 different types. One type was giving the Nazir the wine, or if you will, bringing the boat over and bringing the wine from the boat where he could not have gotten, and then giving him the wine. The other case was giving the person advice. Those are 2 very, very different cases, and to what extent those are the same. And what I really want you to think about is this idea of inviting somebody, is it more like the advice or is it more like the wine? Which one is it more similar to? That's what I want you to think about, and that's what we're going to continue with next time.